WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Ellen Willis is a feminist and social critic who has described herself as obsessed with the idea of freedom. She's written on subjects as diverse as rock and roll, politics, sex, religion, pornography, and the family. She was once described as a natural dissident who is always taking unpopular positions. For instance, she's even criticized certain segments of the feminist movement, such as the anti-pornography groups, which she describes as moralistic. Willis is a former rock critic for The New Yorker magazine, and since the 70s has written for The Village Voice, where she's now a senior editor. In her personal life and in her writing, Willis has explored alternatives to the nuclear family. She once wrote, "I was put off by the marriages I observed. Domestic life, as most of my peers lived it, made me feel claustrophobic. What disturbed me was the degree of emotional repression that most, quote, successful marriages seem to involve." But at the age of 42, Willis started a family of her own. She lives with her daughter, Nona, who is now 4.5 years old, and with Nona's father. I asked Ellen Willis why she decided to take the plunge and create a family, since she had been so committed to living as independently and with as few constraints as possible.
I think the problem is that it's like I never wanted to have a family in the institutional sense of the word. I mean, I wanted to have a lover. And at a certain point, I wanted to have a child. And, you know, wanting to have a child probably for the same complex of reasons, quote, good reasons and neurotic reasons, you know, that everybody wants to have a child from being able to, from having, you know, first of all, a purely erotic, you know, desire to have a child, you know, that soft little baby in your arms. It's like creating a new love relationship. Though I think I never quite articulated that to myself till after she was born, to, you know, wanting to help a new being develop and you know, sort of have somebody with which to kind of transmit your heritage and everything you've learned to the sort of darker aspects of, you know, on some level, probably wanting a little clone of myself, you know, because I really did want a girl. But it's like all those reasons, you know, really sort of have nothing to do in a way with the institution of family. Well, they, I mean, they probably do on some deep psychological level, but and so it was sort of never a choice of let's go out and make myself a family. It was, you know, if I was going to have a lover and we were going to live together, you know, and then we were going to have a child, sort of that kind of created a nuclear family, and which I've never really been happy with that. I would much prefer like a much less isolated kind of situation.
Can you share with us what some of your fears of the nuclear family have been? You know, about having one yourself?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's like a very isolating way to live. Now, Nona's father and I share parenthood, and that's certainly better than doing it yourself. But at the same time, what it means basically is that two people are exhausted all the time instead of one person being exhausted. Nona doesn't have any siblings. You know, I think, like, to try to be a writer, you know, with two people who are trying to do their other work and raise children, like, really becomes very difficult, if not impossible, to envision, you know, having more than one or at the most two children. Nona has to find her community in daycare, and, you know, like, we have a very good cooperative parent-run childcare situation. But, you know, the point is it's, like, very isolating and kind of anti-community, the nuclear family. It's, like, very hard to find time to be with other people, you know, in more than a superficial social life kind of way.
Now, we should say that the father of your daughter is not your husband. You've decided to not get married. And it's an interesting decision to make. I think a lot of people who live together and don't get married end up getting married if they decide to have children. You've had a daughter, she's 4.5, and yet you've still maintained your decision to not get married. How come?
Well, for one thing, I think because we were so pissed off at all the social pressure to get married that, you know, it was just, you know, we weren't going to give in to it. And then I think it's a sort of a symbolic thing. You know, it's kind of a symbolic way of, like, keeping a sense of cultural radicalism alive, although I think it's very symbolic, because I think on a practical level, you're married. Whether you're married or not, when you have a kid in that kind of household, you're married. But I also feel like I had a lot of illusions that somehow, you know, unconscious illusions that somehow by not getting married, I would, like, protect myself from a lot of the problems that marriage and the nuclear family situation inevitably lead to, you know, such as the feeling that you can't get out of this. I mean, the feeling that you want to have that your love affair is a spontaneous thing and you're there absolutely because you want to be there and not because your life is such that it would be, like, really hard to get out of it if you didn't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that kind of thing and the way routine, you know, was sort of so inimical to passion. And, you know, in some way I felt like not getting married would, like, protect us against that, you know, but of course it doesn't. And it's like a big struggle, you know, whether you're married or not.
Feminist social critic Ellen Willis is my guest. You became a mother during what you've described as the worst orgy of cultural sentimentality about babies and family since the 60s. And it's an interesting observation. How do you think this cultural orgy of sentimentality about babies and the family has been expressed in the past few years? What are some examples?
Well, I think, you know, that kind of everywhere in popular culture, pregnancy and parenthood, but particularly motherhood, are glorified. And being, not having children, you know, or being alone, I mean, it's still sort of more respectable than it was before the 60s, but there's, like, been a resurgence of, I think, a great resentment against childless people that they're somehow, they're selfish, they're narcissistic, they're, like, getting away with something. You know, they're not putting their noses to the grindstone. And also where the sentimentality comes in is then that resentment is sort of turned into pity. Well, you're really missing the greatest experiences life has to offer, you know, and so forth.
Did any of that ever get to you, though, even though you really see it as phony sentimentality?
Yeah, I think probably. I mean, it's like, how can it not?
Uh-huh. I always wonder if, you know, a lot of people of the baby boom generation waited so long to have children, if that led to a more self-dramatizing posture about becoming parents.
Yeah, inevitably it does, because I think for one thing, people who are, like, very ambivalent, you know, when you finally decide to come down on one side of the ambivalence, they're sort of an enormous need, I think, in a lot of people to kind of drown out the other side. you know, I mean, I think that I was always very ambivalent about having a child. I never quite gave up the idea. At the same time, you know, I was never quite ready to do it, you know, until I was sort of confronted with the fact that, you know, I'd, like, really better make a decision about this. And I think I'm very glad I did it, but I feel like all the reasons that I didn't want to do it are still true.
Mm-hmm. Such as?
It's just a much harder life, and I feel like in terms of my work and in terms of having time for myself, just to think, just having time for myself, I mean, to develop myself, you know, which I don't think is narcissistic, but a basic human need. And you know, in terms of my sexual and emotional and intellectual life, I mean, it's, like, very difficult in this kind of a society to pay the kind of attention that you need to your child and to being a parent and having a child and to pay attention to all these other things. You know, I don't think that this is sort of, like, inherent in the nature of having a child. I think it's in the nature of how our society is organized.
You recently had an interesting piece in the Village Voice about how in the 60s you were really one of the people who were pushing things to the limit, both sexually, with drugs, with food, with music.
Especially food.
And now you find yourself as a parent, as being the person who's setting the limits and who's doing the things that you might have at one time thought of as very repressive. Has that been a big crisis for you, to see yourself in this new role?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a crisis. I think it's an irony. And it's like in the piece, I was trying to distinguish how I felt about this from the conservative idea that, you know, basically the process of child-rearing is, you know, to take this person with, like, limitless desires and kind of, like, mold them into a civilized being. I think it's almost sort of the opposite that, you know, I think basically I'm for, I mean, I think the children can be, like, basically self-regulating and are, like, much more capable than we give them credit for of being able to set their own limits on things and know what's good for them and know what's bad for them. But that the ways in which we've all grown up, you know, including the way I was brought up, that we ourselves are, like, so neurotic about, you know, we were not brought up in a self-regulated way. And we're sort of so neurotic about our the limits which were set for us and our ambivalence about them and our not, you know, that we transmit that to our children. And, you know, that once you do that, then you have to set limits because you've sort of disrupted the children's ability to do it. So that there's almost like a tragic thing, you know, that goes on from parent to child. And that's sort of what I was trying to convey in that piece.
Mm-hmm. You and what do you call Stanley, who's the father of your daughter, a lover? Or, I mean, do you have a word you like to use?
Well, I think there's sort of no good word for it.
And if you use the word lover, people think that it's like purely sexual. If you use the word significant other, it's a kind of trendy, cold phrase to use.
And partner sounds like a business.
Right.
You know, which a lot of the time when you're kind of administrating a household is...
it's like, kind of true, right?
Yeah.
Spouse equivalent.
Right. The father of my child.
Right.
My friend, companion, lover, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyways, you and he are both cultural and political radicals, I think. That's fair to say. Yes?
Yes.
And so you're really basically in agreement about... you know, the theoretical ways in which one should go about living one's life. But when it comes down to it and you're sharing a household together and it comes time to do the dishes or vacuum the floor or decide who's going to drive your daughter to the daycare center, I don't know how much the politics really come into play because these are like hard daily decisions that have to be made. And I'm wondering if in your house you still go through the same kind of problems and quarrels and discussions that most of us have about dealing with these kinds of things.
Well, I mean, you know, we have definitely the ideology that we should share everything. And at the same time, you're sort of dealing with a situation of scarcity where, like, every, you know, like, especially when Nona was younger, you know, this is getting to be less true, but certainly when she was a baby, when, you know, sort of time is so scarce that you're just both, like, desperate for just, like, a minute of rest or a minute of time for yourself. And, you know, I think that would lead to a lot of struggles, even if it weren't for, you know, sort of all sorts of sexist kinds of dynamics that inevitably come into play. And, you know, I feel like, you know, I think we both pretty much do our best in good faith to try to share everything.
So do you have a system for doing it?
Not really. I mean, it's, you know, part of the problem you come into is that there's so much time spent in administration that the idea of, like, sort of sitting down and preparing a list of things to do for the week is just, like, one extra task that you can't stand, you know, even though it doesn't really save time not to do it because then you end up having fights about, you know, who should do this or that or who last did this or that or, you know, whose turn it is to do this or that. But I think, you know, by this time we've sort of established a pretty good working division of labor about mm-hmm. most things. But then there always are things, you know, like I really have a driving phobia. I have a driver's license, but I hate driving and, you know, it's sort of like definitely, I know, connected with all sorts of things about femaleness. And so Stanley does, like, most of the driving. I mean, virtually all the driving when we're, like, in the city together. And, you know, Nona has been seeing this and I've sort of been very bugged by the fact that she's been seeing this. And, you know, at one point she even said to me, "You have to have a penis to drive, right, Mom?"
Oh, so, I'm sure this is exactly what you wanted to hear.
You know, and I feel like this is really on my agenda as a big thing that I have to deal with. But in the meantime, I'm sort of, you know, she's now like seeing like a lot of other parents and a lot of other women who drive. And, you know, I've sort of tried to make her understand that this is my weirdness and not, you know, not that women can drive. And now she sort of sits in the driver's seat and she pretends that she's driving and she really wants to learn to drive. So, you know, sort of the most important thing is that, you know, she should get the idea that this is great, you know, for her to try to do and, you know, right. So on.
I wonder if becoming a mother has changed your priorities in terms of what you think the feminist agenda should be.
I don't think it's sort of changed my priorities so much in the intellectual sense as, you know, it's obviously made me more aware, more practically, you know, concretely, like immediately concerned with certain kinds of things, you know, particularly, you know, issues of child care and child rearing. And it's like I'm very concerned now because I feel like there's a big push for child care because there are so many women in the workforce, but that since there isn't really a strong feminist movement that's, you know, talking about really feminist-oriented issues about child care and child rearing, you know, I'm really afraid that, you know, what we're going to end up with is just sort of child care that's really designed to help women do their two jobs as efficiently as possible, and, you know, instead of, you know, what we really need, which is sort of a whole reorientation of our idea of what child rearing is, and that it's not simply the mother's job, but, you know, that it's men's and, first of all, men's and women's jobs together, but also not only the parents' job, but really a public concern. So, yeah, I think it's certainly sort of made me think more practically, you know, sort of more deeply about these things in a practical sense rather than a kind of very theoretical sense.
What surprised you the most about becoming a mother? And I'm thinking here that a lot of women I know expected to, like, go right back to work just a few weeks or a couple of months after the baby was born, but ended up staying home and caring for their child a lot longer than they had initially thought that they would, because they wanted to.
Well, I think it was a surprise to me, in a sense, like how much fun it was, how much pleasure it was. And, you know, I feel like I'd read about certain things, but, you know, it's sort of you never quite realize it until it hits you. But there's like this enormous schizophrenia when the child is an infant, and, you know, on the one hand, you're like utterly and like completely exhausted all the time, and it, you know, completely takes over your life. And at the same time, it's like so much fun, and it's like very hard, you know, it's sort of like very hard to realize that it could be like really both those things at the same time. At the same time, it took me like about 4 months, 3 or 4 months, to be ready to go back to work. But by then, I really was ready to start having an outside life again. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't stop. You know, I wanted that. You know, even though I was really having fun with the baby, you know, it was like being home all day would be too much of a good thing.
Mm-hmm. The book that you're starting to write now is on feminism, sex, and the family. And the subject makes me think about how, in really a lot of your writing, sexual freedom has been a very important issue, and that women should be able to enjoy sex as well as men, if you know what I mean. That a lot of people have defined sexual desire as more of a male than a female interest.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm curious about how that aspect of sexuality became so important to your kind of feminist analysis.
I think because when I was growing up, I had so much. I mean, I basically had a conservative upbringing about sex, and, you know, basically throughout my adolescence was in like an enormous conflict about sex, and I was like very angry, you know, just sort of very angry and resentful about the double standard about sex, and about how long it took me to be able to get to the point, you know, sort of where I could really feel clear about my right to have sex and be able to enjoy sex without feeling, you know, without feeling that it was illegitimate, or without feeling that men kind of had the right to judge me, you know, according to the double standard of morality. And, you know, this, you know, just made a huge impression on me, and you know, was sort of like one of the most important things that led to having a feminist consciousness. You know, the other thing was housework. I was very determined from an early age that, you know, I was, you know, for some reason, I, you know, thought it was very unfair that my mother did all the housework. I don't know. I got that consciousness very early, and I was like not going to do the same thing. And I was, you know, very conscious that this was a great injustice. But the other thing was sex.
Well, you came of age during the sexual revolution, quote, in the 60s. And now that a lot of people are almost afraid to have sex because of sexually transmitted diseases, I wonder if you've been rethinking at all the sexual revolution.
Well, you know, first I think that there's only ever, like, really been the beginnings of a sexual revolution, you know, like I said in my article, you know, as early feminists looking at the sexual revolution, we had the same reaction to it that, you know, Gandhi, when asked what did he think of Western civilization, said, I think it would be a good idea. And, you know, we sort of felt the same way about the sexual revolution, you know, like, great idea, but it's really hardly gotten off the ground. That, you know, I think you have to have an affirmation of sex as a good thing, as a need, you know, a physical and emotional need, and as a source of ecstasy and transcendence that's, you know, an extremely important thing to the well-being of people, and that that remains true no matter how risky it may be. You know, I think one has to deal with the risks. One had to deal with the risks of pregnancy. You know, one has to deal with the risks of disease. But that, you know, basically, one has to affirm sex as a good thing, you know, which is something our culture hasn't yet been able to do, you know, even in spite of, I mean, I feel like we just began to do it with the sexual revolution. You know, I think a sexual revolution also entails, you know, genuinely accepting that women have equal sexual needs and equal sexual rights to men, you know, which is still not really accepted. You know, I think a symptom of that is that abortion, you know, still isn't really accepted. And, you know, then I think a real sexual revolution, you know, sort of has to deal with all the dynamics of kind of the deeply anti-sexual and puritanical anti-pleasure upbringing that everybody has. And, you know, I think this process has to go on, and dealing with, you know, things like disease and unwanted pregnancy are practical problems, you know, which we have to undertake, but which could be undertaken in a much more rational way, where we just start from the premise that what we want to do, that our ideal is to, is that everyone should have as much sexual joy in their life as is possible. You know, then you say, how can we deal with AIDS, you know, whatever, in such a manner as, you know, not only to have people survive, you know, and not get sick and not die, but to help them have good sexual lives.
You co-founded a couple of the very early women's consciousness-raising groups in 1968 and 1969 in New York. And I'd be really curious what some of the main issues were at those early meetings and how that compares to what you see as the main issues now.
Well, I think the paramount issue then was just getting into public consciousness that there really was a problem called male supremacy or male, you know, male domination of women, that women were oppressed, and that our kind of main project was like analyzing and again making public like all the different ways in which women were considered as secondary human beings. I mean, a lot of things that are just sort of second nature now and kind of in the air now, simply weren't. I mean, there was sort of a reflexive, taken-for-granted sexism then, you know, that sort of doesn't really exist now. I mean, people thought you were crazy if you said, well, I don't like walking down the street and being hassled by men. What do you mean? They're being appreciative. You know, what are you talking about? I don't, you know, again, things like the sexual double standard, things like men should share the housework, you know, which granted the idea is now honored more in The Breach, that, you know, then it wasn't even, you know, you were really looked on as a nut if you went to a dinner party and said, why are all the women clearing the table and the men aren't doing it? So a lot of our agenda was confronting men on these things, you know, like both on personal lives and also in on a public level, and, you know, doing the same thing with other women, you know, hey, we shouldn't be putting up with this. And this was really what consciousness raising was about. You know, then there was the whole level of public consciousness raising. There was, like, more writing that was being done in those early days of the women's movement than, you know, I can remember from any political movement.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first public policy issue that I think really emerged as a priority was abortion.
I guess that brings that brings us to today, because that's still an issue.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I think it's crucially important now that somehow we have to be able to get off the defensive and, you know, mount an offensive, you know, aimed at keeping and at extending abortion rights, because, in fact, there's been a lot of erosion since 1973, you know, particularly about questions of public funding.